My car, it's a top fuel dragster. I'm sitting in it, and I put on a fire suit, head to toe. I wear socks. I wear a head sock, a helmet, fireproof, everything. I strap myself into this car. I don't know how many of you could have seen it in person, but a Top Fuel dragster, TV doesn't do it justice. If you could see it in person, I wish I could start it up for you right now, because the sound of it, it would just shake this whole room. We took it to Chicago one time to start it up, or just to show it, and they wouldn't even let us start it because it would panic the whole city. I mean, they would think that there was like a bomb. It's 8,000 horsepower, which is one cylinder in the motor is as much horsepower as a whole horsepower in a NASCAR motor, just to give you some kind of idea. It accelerates faster than a rocket ship. It's the fastest accelerating machine on Earth. And actually, in this dragster in the beginning of 2008, I went 335 miles an hour, which qualifies me as the fastest woman in the world. We did that in Phoenix, Arizona last year. And it's absolutely amazing. I mean, I wish that I could describe it to you. I'm sitting here trying to tell you what it's like. And I thought about, like, I wanted to bring a video of it to you, and I wanted to, but you can't even do that. I can't describe it to you. Even the only way you can really understand is to take you to the track and put you in between two cars going down. I mean, it literally like shakes the ground. It shakes your body. And that's the second best way to show you. The first best way to show you is to actually be in the car. And there's very few people who have actually gotten to drive the car, and I'm one of them. And it is the most amazing thing in the world. I have the best job in the world. The fact that I get paid to strap myself into one of these rocket ships and actually get paid to do it is the most amazing thing. I mean, I can't describe how awesome it is to be able to do it. And people look at me and they're like, I mean, you look at me and it's like, she does that? How do you handle that? And it's just, I mean, I just love it. It's like I'm addicted to the speed. I'm addicted to the adrenaline rush. I love to win. I don't compete against girls. I compete against all males. I love beating the boys. And I love that other women can come up to me and say, you're an inspiration to me. I want to succeed in politics. I want to succeed in law. And you're succeeding in a male-dominated field, and you're an inspiration because I feel like I can do the same thing. Maybe it's not in racing. Maybe it's in another field, but it can be the same thing. It's related because it's not easy sometimes. There are a lot of fields in society, a lot of career paths that are dominated by men. And women are breaking into them and succeeding in them. And I just get a lot of positive feedback from women who can come up to me and say, you know, you're succeeding in this, and it's kind of an inspiration to me that you're doing this, and I would like to see my daughter do the same, or I am doing the same. And males say the same thing to me also. It's not easy sometimes. But at the same time, it's fun working with, it's really fun being on the road. We travel a lot, and we race 24 races of the year. We go all across the country. I race in California. I race in Las Vegas. We race in Florida. I mean, every state. We represent every state of the country. Even I went to Australia last year and competed. We represented the United States in a race last December, and we actually won the race, and that was really, really exciting. That was one of the highlights of my career, to represent our country over there. And they were very nice over there and very welcoming to to our team and just rolled out the red carpet for us and treated us like we were royalty, and then to take the trophy and be able to bring it back to this country. And Connie Coletta, who lives, you know, I don't know if a lot of you know, but our team is based out of Michigan. Coletta Air is based out of Willow Run Airport. Connie Coletta built Coletta Air, and then he has this race team, Coletta Motorsports, and so we're run out of there. And I'm kind of skipping all over the place here. Anyway, so I'll back up a little bit. I'm able to be a part of this team. It's Connie Coletta is has this four-car race team. He's been in racing 50 years. It's a very prestigious, well-established race team based right here out of Ypsilanti, Michigan. And it's kind of amazing that I could be a part of it. I'm actually originally from California. I from a small town, and it's kind of funny just to look back and think, you know, how did I end up here? How am I the fastest woman in the world? You know, and how am I part of this? Connie Coletta is a legend in motorsports, and he's built this great race team, and it's just funny the path that sometimes we take in life, and here I am, like, I have people coming up telling me I'm an inspiration. I didn't grow up in elementary school thinking, oh, I'm going to be a race car driver. I'm going to be the fastest woman in the world. I was actually a gymnast growing up, and I loved to flip, and I loved to defy gravity and do things that people said I couldn't do and challenge myself and always, you know, I was always just flipping and doing challenging and doing things that I was afraid of, really, and like jumping off things and doing flips. And and then I got my dad was into cars. It was always a thing. I would go to the races and to spend time with my dad, and he gave me this old junker car when I was 15. He gave me a 73 Dodge Challenger. Let's see, where's the picture? It was brown. He gave it to me when I was 14, and he said, we'll fix it up for you, and you can drive it. And I was like, you know, I was a 15-year-old girl, and I was like, are you kidding me? I'm not going to, you know, but my dad loved this car, so I didn't want to hurt his feelings. And he fixed it up, and then, he, bless his heart, he painted it purple, thinking I was going to like it. And it was a classic, you know, a 73 Dodge Challenger is a very nice classic car. But I had no idea at that time. I just had no idea. But my dad loved the car, and I didn't want to hurt his feelings, and so I drove it. But then all the boys loved me, because it was like, so all of a sudden I was really popular because I was this girl driving this 73 Dodge Challenger. And so I grew to like it, and I grew to understand cars, and I went to car shows with my dad, and I learned to understand and appreciate cars, because it was a way for me to spend time with my dad. Otherwise, we didn't really have anything in common. I liked gymnastics, he liked cars, like, we didn't really have anything in common except, you know, unless it was cars. And so I just kind of learned to like cars, and then it got me attention, and I don't know, it wasn't that bad. And I just grew an interest in it. And then he said, well, why don't you take it down the track and see what kind of numbers it'll run. And I took it down the drag strip. And the first time I hit the throttle, it was so awesome. Like, I hit the throttle and my head flew back. And it was just this exhilarating feeling. I mean, it was like gymnastics, you know, because, like, the flipping and it was just this rush that I loved. And I was hooked. And, I mean, we had to put sandbags in the trunk to keep the tires from spinning. And I had this 300-pound cousin, and we used to throw him in the passenger seat to keep the weight down. I mean, it was just so much fun, though. I was hooked from that day. I loved it. And then one time we went to one of the big races where the big guys were running, and I had never even seen that. And we, you know, where these cars were running, and I didn't know that existed. We went, and I was like standing up against the fence, my face pressed against it, and I just thought it was the most amazing thing. And I was like, man, one day, I was only 17, I was like, one day I'm going to do that. And it was just from, it's just one of those things. It was like this calling that I knew, you know, that one day I was going to do that. And then I just progressively, you know, I raced with my family, and we progressed, and then we kind of worked our way up. I raced, my dad also had a Challenger that he raced in high school, or that he drove in high school, and he kept it over the years. It kind of got rusty in the garage, but he took it out one day and kind of fixed it up, and I was able to get some sponsors, and we kind of fixed it up, and I don't know, you can't see it very well, but there's a picture of it there, and yeah, that was Super Street. That was a 10-second car. I didn't mention that first car that I drove was only 99 miles an hour. Like, it ran 15 seconds. But I loved it. I mean, needless to say, I loved it. What? The Challenger? The 70? Oh. I'm sorry.
I was wondering what a 10-second car was.
What do you mean, what is it? Oh, it's in drag racing. It goes from, I'm sorry, it means it does the quarter mile in 0 to 10 seconds. Or it does the quarter mile in 10 seconds. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry, I'm used to drag racing terms. It mean, yeah. I slowly worked my way up through the ranks in drag racing. Like, I started out doing the quarter mile in 14 seconds and then moved my way up to a faster car. Then I was doing it in 12 seconds. And then that car, eventually, we built a bigger motor for it. And then we did it. So I was doing the quarter mile in 10 seconds, 150 miles an hour. And then, can you guys still hear me? Okay. And then I had to go away to college. And that's when I went to Wheaton College in Massachusetts, so I moved all the way across the country, and I knew this racing business was expensive. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna have to make a lot of money because this is an expensive hobby. So I'm gonna have to get rich, and I think, okay, I'm gonna be an economics major. I'm gonna go work on Wall Street. I'm gonna make all this money, and then I'm gonna retire when I'm like 40, and I'll go racing. And so this is my plan, right? And so the first summer comes around from college, and I think, okay, well, I should go get an internship, you know, on Wall Street so I can start learning, like, this business banking or something. And I'm like, no, I'm going to go home and race one more summer. So I go home and race, and I'm loving it. It is so fun. We start winning more, and I just can't, like, I'm like, how can I ever, like, I can't give this up till I'm 40. How am I going to do this? And so I go back to school, and then thinking that's my last summer. And then just every summer I keep going home, and we start to get sponsors. And then we get a dragster. There's a picture of it. Sorry. Oh, here. Oops. This is my first dragster. So I'm racing with my family still, and this dragster was 140 miles an hour in the quarter mile, and it ran 8.9 seconds. And this, I thought I loved drag racing. Once I got on this, no, I really loved it. Like, sitting on the ground in that car, I was sitting enclosed and behind the motor. Now you're in a dragster, you're sitting on the ground in front of the motor. There's nothing like it. I mean, it's just amazing. You've got the open air coming on you. I mean, I would like think about it night and day. I mean, I couldn't get the thoughts out of my head. I was like, this is it. I got to figure out a way to do this. And then so, you know, every summer through college, I'm going back home so I can race. I'm I'm making proposals in college, like how to get sponsors. Meanwhile, I'm still getting good grades. I'm getting like straight A's. Like I'm still, you know, I'm gonna get rich because I'm gonna do this racing thing. But I'm thinking, well, maybe I can get sponsors too, and figure out how. And I'm even meeting with the guidance counselors now at my college, trying to get them to help me to get sponsors. And I'm at this, you know, East Coast college, ivy on the walls and everything. You know, they don't know anything about drag racing. It's Massachusetts. Like, there's no drag strips anywhere. And here I am in the library with all my drag racing pictures spread out, and people are, you know, like, what are you talking about? Drag racing. And then I want, like, by my senior year, I'm starting to take time off to go drag racing and trying to ask my professors, like, for time off. And like, it's a very liberal school, and you don't drag race. And I don't know. I had to start, like, making up stories about, yeah, I'm going for a job interview. And, like, it was kind of funny because it's just a funny mix of liberal arts major and economics and drag racer. It just wasn't really mixing very well. But needless to say, I graduated, did well, and I moved back home because my dad was like, if you're going to race, you're going to have to come back home. You know, you're going to have to move home and help with the cars and everything. And so I moved back to California, and I got a job as a financial analyst. And the money wasn't rolling in, though, like I had planned. You know, I thought, you know, you just don't get an entry-level job, and you know, and then you don't get the time off to go racing like I needed. So it was just like this paradox that wasn't working out. Like, how do you get the time off to go racing all the time and make enough money to go racing? It just was this conundrum that didn't work out. I got this good job. I mean, it was just hard because you don't. I just was really like perplexed because how do you go racing? How do you have a job to make enough money to go racing? Get all this time off? Just didn't work out. But I stayed at this financial analyst job for 2 years. I don't know how I did it. I still built up my racing career. I moved my way up slowly, slowly got sponsors. I went to a drag racing school in Florida, saved up enough money. I didn't live on much. I didn't have a bed in my house. I slept on the couch. I just saved money, and every dollar that I had, I put in racing. I charged up my credit card bills. I don't know what I was thinking, but it was like, I'm going to be a drag racer no matter what. And I worked really hard at my financial analyst job. When I was there, I worked 12, 14-hour days. And I was just really fortunate. They would let me have 4-day-off weekends because I made up for it when I was there. And I was on salary, thankfully. So, you know, I still got decent money to live. And then when I've lived very, very meekly. You know, I didn't go shopping. I didn't hardly eat. I spent all my money on drag racing. And thankfully, my family was very, very supportive. I mean, I think my dad spent his retirement, and we just got very wrapped up in it. Looking back, we probably, it's almost an addiction. You know, you just get going, and we probably spent more money than we should have. But it was like, you know, it's this dream that you have, and we went for it. We were going for it. And we started winning a lot, and one day I just decided, you know, I'm going to go for it and really go for it and make this happen, or I'm not, you know. One day I quit my job. I sold everything in my house, which wasn't much, and we went on the road and just went racing full time. And I had credit card debt already, but I ran it up, and we ha- had, we were really lucky. We just won a lot. And I turned into our team's PR person. I made up a fake name and made up our own press releases and really, like, got our name out there. And because it was more, you can't just win. You know, people, you don't just win. People have to know about you winning. So you have to get a lot of media exposure and press and do all this stuff and really make hype. And I slapped this Girl Power logo on our car. And so, you know, that gets a little bit of attention to be in the drag racing world and, you know, to have a car with like this with Girl Power on the side. You don't think that got attention in a male-dominated sport. You know, people loved it, people hated it, but it got us some attention. And then, so, but we were setting records and we were doing really well. I mean, it wasn't just hype. There was, it wasn't fluff. There was actual meat behind it. I mean, and I loved it. I wasn't just out there like trying to be something that I wasn't and trying to get attention. I wasn't just trying to, you know, trying to be famous. I really loved driving and I really like, you know, I had the ability to drive. And so I got the call one time that everybody dreams about. I mean, it was amazing. I was in debt up to my ears. I didn't have a place to live. I mean, we were on the road just traveling. And I don't know where it was all headed. But one day, Connie Coletta and Ken Black called me. They had decided to form this Top Fuel team. And they called me and asked me if I would be their driver on this professional race team. And it was my dream. When I was that girl standing with my face pressed against the fence at the race with my dad, which was my dream, that was it. I mean, they called and asked if I wanted to do this. And I was in Canada at this race with my family. And they called and I was like, yes, yes, yeah, I'll do it. And I just, you know, I had to fly to Minnesota for an interview and they hired me on the spot. And next thing I knew, I was, they put me in their race car and I licensed and I was driving. And I moved here right away. I was living in California, or I wasn't living anywhere really, but but I'm from California. I moved here and it was nice because I actually had a house and an address. And I've endured 4 Michigan winters since then. but I tell you, you know, it's been a struggle being in Top Fuel, being, you know, it's the pros. It's racing. It's no cakewalk. Like I thought, you know, I got hired and I thought, cool, I've made it. I'm a professional racer now. And I tell you what, like, I thought I was free, you know, like, life's good. I'm being paid to race, but man, it was just getting tough. I thought it was tough, like, getting there. But let me tell you, like, I mean, you're racing other male racers, and you're dealing with sponsors and money, and these people want to win. And it is 0 to 330 miles an hour in 4.5 seconds. There is no time for error or mistakes. You blink, and you can crash. I mean, you blink. If I'm driving and I even glance over at my competitor, the car will go that way. If I make one little mistake, the race is lost. Races are won and lost by thousands of a second. And then that's it. It's just over. You go home. You pack up. The race is over. You go home. It's not like NASCAR or baseball. You swing and you miss. Okay, you get two more swings. Drag racing is, that's it. It's over. The race is over. One mistake, it's done. Or one mistake and that's your life. It's done. The race, I mean, it's a very dangerous, very punishing sport. And I've learned really a lot of hard lessons. But we've also really had a lot of good times. I mean, this event right here was my first win last year in June in Topeka. And it was probably one of the best days of my life. I mean, it was so awesome. We beat Larry Dixon, who was a 3-time world champion. Don the Snake Prudhomme's team, I mean, they're very famous. And we beat him in the final round. And it was just the most awesome day. We worked really hard for that, and last year we finished fourth in the country. We were second for most of the year, and it was just, we went to the semis five times, I think, and went to the finals three times, and just had an awesome year. It was really just a lot of fun, and just to succeed, and that was, last year was also when we set the records, and it was just amazing to, we overcame a lot of obstacles, and we had, because in 07 there was a crash, and it was just really fun, you know, to have to overcome all these things that happened, and to go out and win. And I don't know, I look at this picture all the time, and it was just a good day. And so now, where I am now is, I haven't raced at all this year because of the way the economy is and the funding. We don't have our team doesn't have funding this year, so I've been trying to secure sponsorship to get back out on the track. I know that racing is what I love. I mean, obviously, I think it's apparent that I have a passion for it, and so I'm trying to get myself back out on the track. And I work with an excellent team here. We're based, obviously, here out of Michigan. And I'm just not really sure how to do it. You know, there's a lot of good teams out there. There's not like a set way that you get sponsors. You know, I've been able to kind of figure my way. You know, there's not an instruction book how to even get to Top Fuel. You know, like there's a, when you become a doctor or a lawyer, there's kind of a path. You know, but to become a Top Fuel driver, there wasn't a path. I feel like I have just been kind of very fortunate. I've been very blessed and kind of got here. And now, you know, I'm in this place now, and I don't have a sponsor, and I'm not sure really where things are going to go. And so I'm just trying to take it day by day and figure out what my next step is and figure out how I, you know, they're expensive to run, so figure out what my next step is to get the funding to keep running, because it's a great sport to be a part of, and I definitely have a passion and want to keep going. So I appreciate you guys all listening to me. It keeps going in and out. I hope I was clear in what I was saying. I know that some of you are raising your hands along the way.
If you have questions, I can come to them.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Two questions. One, I noticed you have tape on the side of the visor, the helmet. Is that so you don't get distracted?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, that tape is there because our eyes are trained to move constantly. Because we have blind spots. But when we drive, when I drive a dragster, we have to, or any driver who drives a dragster this fast, you actually have to concentrate to keep your eyes from moving constantly like they want to do. I have to keep them glued, like absolutely straight ahead, and keep them from blinking or moving. And the tape helps so I don't see any peripheral vision. Because, yeah, the tendency is, if I'm racing somebody, I want to look over and see if I'm beating them. But I can't let my eyes look over. And it's like an indulgence, kind of, to let myself look over and see where my competitor is. And I just can't do that. And, and they teach drivers in the beginning, like, the tendency is to look out close or just look. I mean, you have to glue your eyes straight ahead. Otherwise, if anywhere you're looking, the car will go. I mean, even if you just glance quickly, anyway, the car will just go that way because everything happens so fast.
So when you're going that fast, what are you looking at or aiming towards? Just
I'm looking straight out past the horizon.
Past
the finish line. Yeah. And that was when I went to the drag racing school in Florida that I mentioned. I actually, the first run I had, I struggled a little bit. I was driving a 220 20-mile-an-hour car for the first time, and that was the first time I really had trouble keeping the car straight. And they didn't tell, and I said, you know, what is the problem? Why am I having so much trouble keeping the car straight? And the instructor, Frank Hawley, explained to me that whole thing about, well, our eyes are just trained to go so fast all the time, and that's just the way they work. They're supposed to do that. And so when I'm in the dragster, that's just what they're doing. And so then the car is kind of moving too, because that's what our eyes do. So I have to consciously not let my eyes do that. So that when I learned to drive a dragster of that kind of speed, I had to untrain my eyes to move like they wanted to.
Yeah. The second question is, why are you living here in Michigan, I guess as a driver, since you travel so much, wouldn't you want to live like in a warmer area where you could practice? And yeah.
That is a great question. I would want to live somewhere warmer. I love the warm weather and the sun. But I like being a part of the team. My team and my car is based here, and they come back here and they work on the car in between races. And I just really like being a part of the team, and I like to see what they're doing in between races, and I like to interact with them. And if they need help with the car, which sometimes I get more in the way than help. I mean, in the past, drivers used to be able to work on the cars a lot more, and now they don't want drivers to. They want drivers to just focus on driving and sign autographs and deal with the sponsors. But I wish they would let me help, and sometimes I ask. I sometimes will be like, can I please help? Please just let me do something. And I like to show up at the shop and ask if I can help, or just, I don't know. I just like to be at the shop and be of help if I can. I like to go to lunch with my team. I like the camaraderie. I like just to be there. And, I can, a lot of drivers do, like, live in Southern California or Las Vegas while their teams are working in Indy or whatever. But I don't know. I feel like it's more of a team to be with my team, or, you know, it's like a team sport.
Can you hear? Okay. Great story, Hillary. Thank you very much. And I wasn't long behind you coming from California. So I had a question for you about what kind of staff do you need support on a team? In other words, I would admit, I know you need mechanics and technicians. You probably have engineers and logisticians and people that arrange your travel and all that sort of thing. Can you talk about that for a minute?
At Coletta Motorsports, when we had 4 race cars running at our highest, which was last year, we had about 50 staff members, or 50 members. On each car, there's about 8 crew guys who work full-time on each car, plus there's the crew chief. There's 4 guys who stay at the shop and work in the machine shop, and they just stay at the shop full-time. They don't go to the races. We have 2 office staff who do the book work. We have a PR person and a team manager and 2 marketing people, and 1 person who takes care of hospitality, and then another person who does like the cooking and stuff for the team on the road. So it's a good amount of people and a variety, and we have, I don't know, at one time we had some people with engineering degrees, and just a variety of backgrounds. We have some people who graduated from WyoTech, some people with no educational background, you know, secondary educational background, just a varying degree of experience.
I wanted to ask you, too, if I could, about, are they down to 3 teams now, or are they running some teams at Coletta, or are they taking a year off? And at what point do you decide that, if I can ask this, that you have to start looking around so that you can keep racing?
At Coletta, there's 2. They're running the funny car driven by Jeff Arend, sponsored by DHL, and the dragster driven by Doug Coletta. Connie may bring out another car this year, as maybe it would be in the test capacity. I'm not sure. And I'm guessing he would bring back David Grubnick to run that. And I'm just trying to get a sponsor to bring back my car. Ken Black owns my car, and it was owned by Ken Black and managed by Connie, or managed by Coletta Motorsports. Ken owns it. He's out of Las Vegas, and he just has Coletta manage it, and that's the way it's been. And it's really just dependent on when I get a sponsor, and which I'm trying to do. I don't know how to do it, but I'm working on it. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Who actually builds these things, and what are the engines like? Are regular tire engines that are?
The actual chassis is built by Chuck Lett. He's out of Charlotte, Michigan, and he has a company called Attack Race Cars. And there's three companies in the country that I know of that build dragsters: Murph McKinney. I can't remember the other one. And Attack what?
Hadman.
Yeah, Hadman. Hadman, Brad Hadman. Yeah, and Attack Race Cars. And so he builds. We buy ours from him, and then our motors. We get a lot of our parts from Alan Johnson, race cars, and then we do a lot of in-house work in our machine shop too.
Okay, if you have a question, you could take the microphone.
Yes, Hillary. Would you ever consider going to Funny Car if someone offered you a job driving a Funny Car?
I have been presented with a couple different opportunities to drive a Funny Car, and I haven't really pursued them. I don't have an interest in driving a Funny Car.
Okay, unlike Melanie Traxel. And
no, you know, and it was like I described how when I first drove the dragster,
yeah.
I love driving a dragster. I like sitting on the ground. Is everyone familiar with the Funny Car? I don't have a picture of it, but it's the short wheelbase car and
same horsepower.
Yeah, and dragsters are faster. I like sitting on the ground. I like sitting in front of the motor. I like the dragster. Yeah.
Well, I got another question for you.
Okay.
Are you employed by Ken Black? Is that basically still, or because I know Connie runs the racing, but you were hired by Ken Black, weren't you?
Yes, I was hired by Ken.
Okay,
yes.
With Greg Anderson and all that other stuff. So.
Right.
Okay.
Since the engines don't last very long between runs, how do you get time in to do practicing, and what kind of practicing do you do?
Me personally?
Yes.
As a driving practice?
Yes.
I have a practice tree, which I don't, if you all don't know what that is, in drag racing, the Christmas tree is the lights that come down that tell us when we go. Oh, there's a picture of it somewhere. Like this. Oops. Like this. This is called, we call it a Christmas tree. I have an actual one like that in our shop set up, and I have an actual cockpit from my car, an old one that sits in our shop, so I can sit in it, and it feels like a real car, and that way I can practice my reaction times. But other than that, there's not a lot of ways to practice. We can't take it out in our parking lot. We can't go out to the local drag strip and practice. It's kind of like do or die. We take it out on the track, and I practice in my head mentally, but that kind of got to be where I hurt myself more that way, because I would go over it so much in my head that I started to make myself go crazy, because you can only go over it so much in your head, you know, that it starts to, you just think about it too much and think about it too much. Because drag racing, you can't think too much. You just have to do it, and you just have to trust yourself. And that becomes, it's all about confidence, and it's all about trusting yourself, which is really cool because that can be applied to so many things in life. It really became like a life lesson to me, because you just go up there, and I knew I could drive, and you just go do it. You know, you really don't have time to think, because you're just reacting to things, you're trusting yourself, you're reacting to the car. And I drove the best when I didn't think, if that makes sense. Like, I had to train myself, like, when I overthought about it and overanalyzed it, I couldn't drive. But when I learned to just trust myself and respond to the car, and I drove, that's when I drove the best. And that's when we had our best year last year. And that's what I had to learn how to do. It's when I'm sort of going on a tangent here, but it's kind of an interesting life lesson, because I think it can be applied to a lot of things in life. Because when we trust ourselves and we do what we know how to do, we're better at things. And anyway, I don't know where I was going with that.
Do you do any physical training?
Yes, I do. I believe being stronger, I have to be strong to drive that car. So I do a lot of running, weightlifting, kickboxing, and reaction time is huge in those, because, like I said, everything's happened so fast. You just have to react. Your muscles have to be quick. And so I do a lot of, you know, my muscles have to be strong. So I weightlifting, kickboxing, and just, you know, I've always been in shape from, you know, gymnastics and stuff like that.
Any other questions?
I have a couple questions,
okay,
or things I'd like to hear your thoughts about.
Okay.
The first is, I've been at the starting line when you guys light those monsters off. And you're right, it's indescribable. The air moves around you, moves you. You can't keep your teeth closed or they rattle. I would like to hear your thoughts, or if you could possibly try to describe what it's like to be there in that car when that thing lights off. And the second is, what are your thoughts about the reduction of the quarter mile? It's no longer a quarter mile. You know, what are the insiders' thoughts? Are they going to go back to the quarter mile, or is this a battle with the insurance companies, blah, blah, blah? So a couple of thoughts there, please.
Okay. I love talking about what it feels like to be in the car, because I just can't describe it. You know what I mean? Like, I wish somebody could be in the car with me, you know, to experience it. Because, like I said, when I drove these other 150 mile an hour cars, it was awesome, you know, but I am going over 100 miles an hour in less than a second, like from a dead stop to over 100 miles an hour in less than a second. Like, can you just grasp that? I mean, and I, my eyes are like wide open, and it's just, and like, when I'm going 330 miles an hour in 4.5 seconds, but yet the more I do it, it seems like it takes like 20 seconds. And I can come back to my crew chief and say, okay, at this point in the run, the car was doing this. At this point in the run, it sounded like this. At this, I mean, I can talk about it. I can take 2 minutes to describe what happened in that 4.5 seconds. I mean, it's amazing. It's like slow motion. It's absolutely amazing. Like, it's just, and the thing is, too, it's like quiet. Louder when you're standing in the middle of the cars. For me, and it's sitting in there, it's like, it's almost peaceful. You know, when I'm at the races, like, there's all these people around. There's tons of people who go to the races, right? For any of you have been there. And drivers, like, you know, you have to go do all these things for sponsors and fans, and you're, like, going around and talking to all these people, and they're like, you know, do this, do that. And it's like my peaceful time, and like my favorite time in my life, when I get in this monster of a car, because it's my time. Nobody talks to me. I get in this car, and it's just me and this race car, and it's like my favorite time on Earth. It's like, it's really weird to describe, because it's like this dangerous, you know, really dangerous machine. Like, my mom is like, doesn't understand this day. She's seen me race in person maybe 3 times in my life, you know, but it's just this most amazing that I can find peace in this, you know. It's just awesome. That's the only way I mean to describe it, and I think other drivers would say that too. It's just peaceful, you know, for me to be in a fire suit and a helmet. And like, I mean, one time I was going 300 miles an hour, and you understand, the motor's behind me, and the thing exploded, and I saw, I had flames go in front of me and like envelop me. And just, I mean, it's crazy to think that, you know, just to have a motor behind you and then to have flames coming around you, and you know, it's just, so it was kind of a fun experience too. But and it gets a little bit warm, and it's like, it just kind of throws you forward. And so to answer your next question, I could go on about, you know, just racing, you know, what it feels like all day. So we used to run 1,320 feet, and now they've shortened it to 1,000 feet for safety reasons. Yes, my teammate and friend, and I'm wearing his bracelet. I think it's a very good idea that they've shortened it. NHRA, our sport, has poured a ton of money into speeding the cars up. And the technology for making the cars better and faster has improved greatly over time. Yet, the same amount of money has not been spent on improving the tracks, improving the facilities, and improving the safety equipment. There's not as much incentive to improve that, the safety equipment and the facilities, as there is incentive to improve speeds and the ETs. So there had to be some kind of immediate something done to for safety. For the safety of people's lives. I loved going 1,320 feet. You know, I loved going 330 miles an hour. That was my decision to put myself in that car. You know, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, if we went, it's a driver's decision to put themselves in that, you know. So it's very controversial, and I can see why fans, you know, aren't liking it at 1,000 feet. And you know, you have all this controversy about, well, diminish the value of the sport and the records and that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know, but I do know it's a lot safer now. I don't foresee it going to 1320 anytime soon, no. I don't think, just knowing what I know about what the teams within the sport, I don't think they want to go. I don't think many of the teams are really up for going to 1320.
I think that has more to do with liability insurance than anything else, because the sanctioning bodies in the tracks are scared, and they don't want another incident, and they don't want anybody hurt. Obviously, safety is the first thing that's on everybody's mind. But I think the misconception of drag racing is that it is a dangerous sport. Yes, there are many dangers that can happen, but when you look at the vast amount of passes that are made safely over the course of dozens of years, it's the safest motorsport that we have. It's much more safe than NASCAR. Can you address that? I think it's a very safe sport. I mean, considering Scott's death, you would have to say there's danger involved. When you get in that cockpit and you say you're peaceful, if tire shake hits or if a cylinder goes out after you've already gone 100 miles an hour in a second, that's got to change your mindset just a little bit. And it's out of your control.
I can't don't. I mean, but I do it. I put myself in the car.
You must feel safe within yourself.
Yeah, I put myself in the car. I mean, we make it as safe as possible. But like I said, I don't think the same amount of money, the amount of improvements to make the cars faster and quicker, the amount of money that has been put into that has not been put into the improving the tracks and improving the safety equipment. Absolutely. Right. Right. And right. And that is the big thing.
Hillary, if you wouldn't mind sharing some of the behind the scenes stuff, like what kind of arsenal you guys have to show with, number of motors, the in between maintenance, the rounds, how quick it all happens, you know, when they redo a motor, and a little bit about nitromethane, because I suspect a lot of people don't know what it is and how much it costs.
Yeah, a lot goes on behind the scenes. It's pretty amazing to watch too, and that's the great thing about our sport is everybody, you can come up and watch. I mean, every ticket's a pit pass, so you can come up and watch it as it happens. We carry about 8 motors with us in our trailer to every race. They're lined up. We carry 2 cars with us, and like I said, we have 8 guys on every team. Plus the crew chief, and they have to come back and tear down the motor after every run. Even if we just did a burnout and come back, they will bring the car back and tear down the motor. And, yeah, we run on nitromethane. We burn between 13 to 15 gallons of fuel on every run. I'm not sure exactly what the cost is of nitromethane these days. Yeah, sometimes they have to rebuild the motors. Sometimes they'll come by and say we have 60 minutes if they want to get through race day real quick. Generally it's 70 to 90 minutes though. And it's just amazing to watch how these guys can, I mean, they completely tear down the motor and rebuild it all the way back, and then we're ready to run, and it's just like a brand new car. Sometimes they have to take the motor completely out and then replace it also. And sometimes in that, we may have had an explosion also. I mean, sometimes the car will completely burn. I mean, not burn down, but like we'll have an explosion and it'll burn, and then the car will come back and we'll have to clean up a big mess, and we'll be prepared for the next round within 70 to 90 minutes.
With regard to the engines, why not just swap them out rather than do the rebuild live? Like, do the rebuild in the evening between, you know, days of runs. Is it because it takes too long to swap them and it's faster to rebuild them?
No, a lot of times because there's more variables, and I think they get used to that motor. They want to keep that particular one that they like. But I know, too, I've seen my crew chief just say, get that one out of the, you know, on race day, if there's not enough time, they'll just say, yank it out, get another one in there. But I think they try to just, as much as they can, keep that same motor in there and tear it down and build it back. That saves money, too, obviously.
Hillary, yes. What is your favorite track that you race on the NHRA circuit?
That's a good question. They're in Denver this weekend, and that's my favorite city to go to because it's fun area to be in. And it's actually a nice track, too, for spectators because it's built into the mountain, and it's just a really nice place. It's hard on the crew chiefs, though, because it's the altitude. It's so high. It's really hard on the crew chiefs there. I like Vegas because that is where I got my first win in top alcohol, and but then that kind of ruined it. That's where we had a crash there in 2007. We had a tire come apart, and my car went into 1,000 pieces, and that's kind of a bad memory. So that track, it isn't necessarily my favorite anymore. But And then Topeka, that was where my win was, so there's good memories from there. And Norwalk. Yeah, that's a good track. That's like my home track now because that's so close to here. Yeah, we won the World Nationals there in 2006, and Scott went to the finals there, and they have the best ice cream. They have like dollar ice cream. They're like these huge, yeah. And they just had an event there a couple weeks. You guys, I definitely recommend going to Norwalk.
What did you think about Z-Max?
Oh, it's a great racetrack. It's like
all the Bruton Smith ones. All the Bruton Smith tracks.
Yeah, all the Bruton Smith tracks are so nice.
Well,
and
Bristol.
Yeah, Bristol's nice. Yeah, I haven't had. I didn't go there this year, but yeah. No, I'm definitely going to Charlotte this year too, to the Z-Max drag. Are you going there? Yeah, good. Yeah, definitely recommend it. It's so, and they're doing at Z-Max. They have two drag strips side by side, and they actually did this year for the first time. They ran four cars down at the same time, and I guess they just packed people in. I mean, it was like standing room only, I heard. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. But, oh, was it? Was it on TV? Oh, yeah. So that's really exciting. And if they do that more often, I think that could be really great for our sport. That could really take off. And imagine if we could have four top field dragsters go down the track at the same time. I mean, I would love that. That would be awesome. So awesome. I mean, I don't know. I just think that would be really cool. And I don't know. Bruton seems to be on the cutting edge of, you know, just has really good ideas. And it'd be really cool if we could implement some more of his ideas and really take our sport to the next level. You know, I would like to see it, you know, go to the next level and do a lot of these things. Sorry, go ahead.
You mentioned the tear down and rebuild an engine. What do they actually do? What parts do they replace or so forth in this hour?
It just depends how much damage is done a lot of the times. They tear it down. They'll definitely replace all the rings and pistons and, Well, sometimes they like to keep the same blower. The blower can keep the same life on that for a long time. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we change our blower belts every run, I think. In fact, Ken used to say he wanted to invest in a blower belt company because he'd get that bill all the time. And yeah, our clutches. We can keep a set of tires for two or three runs generally. Sometimes, there's been times where we've had to replace them every run, you know, because they'll chunk or get used up. Did that answer your question?
I don't know much about drag racing, but I'm a skater and I have to practice on the ice every week. And if I understood you correctly, you don't practice in the car. And I'm wondering, are the engines too delicate? Is it too expensive? Would you practice in the car if you had a sponsor?
That's a good question. They figure that it costs about $5,000 every time we go down the track. So that's why we don't test. And my first year, we actually did test a lot. We would test after. We were allowed to test Monday after the race. We would test a lot of new parts and new. To try new things, and now there's been a rule made that testing isn't allowed anymore because of costs, and I don't even know why they made the rule. I don't know. There's been a lot of reasons, a lot of tires and different reasons why we're not supposed to test as much anymore, and we'll get deducted points if we test. But a big reason that held us back from testing is cost. And it's just, it uses up a lot of parts, it takes a lot of time. I mean, the whole team has to go and, you know, you have to pick up the whole team, travel to a track, set up, unload, and run the car. Just to make one run. You make one run, then you have to come back, tear it down. And it takes a whole day just to make 3 or 4 runs. So,
how did drag racing get started in the first place? I mean, I think Indianapolis type racing got started because they were actually testing things, wasn't it? But how did drag racing get started?
I believe it got started by Wally Parks in the 1950s. That's how the NHRA got started. You know, I don't know how I think drag racing has been around before that, but the NHRA got started by Wally Parks in the 1950s when he started the association, National Hot Rod Association, as a and really it became a sanctioning body for racers to go racing. It started in Southern California, with the Fremont drag strip and in Pomona.
Hi. My question is, you indicated that it's primarily a male-dominated field, so I know you've proven yourself now, but when you first broke into the field, did you experience a lot of problems with other racers? Or was there a lot of, rivalry for you coming in as a woman? And I mean, I guess, in my opinion, you probably wouldn't be a typical female racer. You know, you're not all big and buff and all that. So how was it?
That's a great question, because when I first, I didn't realize that it was something different. My dad just took me to the races, and I didn't think anything of it. My dad took me to the races. I guess he could have told me to stay home and play with my dolls, but he didn't. And I didn't think, I'm a female drag racer. I just thought, I just want to race. And I just really didn't think anything of it. And it wasn't really, and I just did it for a while. And it wasn't really until I started doing well that we would get some. I remember one time this guy, after I beat him, just throwing a fit. And he did, and he screeched off with his car. And some of them would just act really stupid. And I would kind of, look at my dad, what was that all about? And my dad would just be kind of like, he would just kind of, don't worry about it. And then when we got into the bigger ranks, it was just, we would get some guys that just really were assholes. I mean, they were. And especially, and I don't know, I still wonder if I should have done this or not, but when I put the Girl Power logo on my car, that was, it was not okay. It really wasn't. One time I had a team beat me after I had beat them many, many times. And they were screaming, "Man Power," in my face. And in a mean way, I sort of thought like we were friends. And then, I was really taken aback by it when they were screaming "Man Power" in my face. And I don't know, to this day it was kind of like, and then I don't know, I was kind of, I don't know, I was just not, like, I kind of wanted to be friends with everybody in the pits, but when you're winning and you have Girl Power on the car, and they're in the pits with all these guys, you're not really liked that much, and you kind of have to realize, I wasn't there to be friends with all these people, I just learned a lot of lessons, do you want to be friends with all these people, or do you want to be a competitor, and do you want to go out there and win? You're not there to, it's not this, because with racing, there is a lot of camaraderie, and you barbecue with your competitors, and you do Like, there is a lot of camaraderie in the pits, especially in the amateur ranks and stuff. But it's just kind of different, I think, for a girl on a girl's team with girl power on her car when she's qualifying number one and doing a lot of winning. And I just didn't realize it. It just really surprised me. It was okay when I wasn't winning and when I was just kind of under the radar. But there was a lot of changes once I started winning and, you know, bringing attention to the fact that I was a girl. I just didn't know that there was going to be a problem. I just didn't know what that did. And then when I went pro, I was actually asked the question a lot. Like, reporters would ask me, what's it like to be a female in racing? And I was always asked that. And it just, I didn't know how to answer that because it was like, I'm just a racer, you know? And I didn't, it was like, I just want to be a racer. And now I understand, like, yes, I'm a female, and it means a lot that I'm competing in a male-dominated sport, and I'm succeeding in a male-dominated field. And yes, it is, women have a difficult time sometimes, you know, succeeding in male-dominated fields like politics or law or, you know, it's like I can be an example. I didn't realize that. I just wanted to be a racer, and I just wanted to drive a car. You know, and so that's why I didn't know it was like just to stick girl power on my car. It was like a thing. You know, I was like putting myself out there, you know, to like make myself stand out to be, I don't know. There's a lot to it. I just didn't realize. So I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm getting into a lot, but, you know, because to go back to your question, I don't know, what was your original question? Okay.
You got to keep that on there.
Well, no, I don't have that. I didn't have that on my car. Eventually, I was pressured to take that off the car.
I wanted to ask you about, I'm a control systems guy, so I'm curious about the onboard computer control systems, and I would imagine you have ignition and fuel delivery control. I was wondering if you have suspension, any controls in the suspension, if you have, like for the clutches, are they computer controlled? Do you know what the onboard, can you talk about what the onboard systems are for control, and related to that also what you have for data acquisition?
That's a great question. There is actually great technology. You'd really be surprised about the advances in technology that's been made. I mean, they can record everything on that car going down the track, and that's, I guess, not good for a driver because I can get away with nothing. I mean, they know every mistake that I've done. I can come back and say, "Oh, well, I didn't do that," and they'll say, "Oh, yes, you did." They have like this black box on there that records everything. It'll record, I mean, even regardless of what I did, it records everything going on with the motor, the cylinder temperatures, the clutch, I mean, everything, even beyond what I know. And a lot of it is just pre-programmed. It's not even under my control. The crew chief should get, and I think hopefully does, get a lot more credit than the driver on how these cars run, because they're the ones setting it all up to make it run and programming it and controlling it and setting it up according to the air temperature, and I mean, actually, the crew chiefs don't get enough credit. I mean, I've sat up here and haven't even given my crew chief credit for doing all this stuff. I've been rambling on about myself, and they're the masters behind all this. I mean, all this technology, they make the cars run, and I just get in it, and not just, but, I mean, there's a lot of, they program the cars, and I hit the throttle, yeah, and there's a lot to driving, but at the same time, there's a lot to what they have to do that I know very little about, actually. And so my crew chief, who is Jim Oberhofer, would be able to explain that a lot better. About all what they have to do, you know, as far as the the clutch, the timing, the all the stuff, you know. And there's actually a belief now that the less the driver knows, the better. They really think that, and they tell me that all the time. Like, just don't worry about it. You just drive the car, because I have to respond not to what I think is the car is set up to do, but what the car is telling me. Listen to the car, feel the car, because the car will tell me how to respond if I have to pedal it, if I have to hit the, you know, what I need to do, how I need to react inside the car. The car will tell me, regardless of whatever the crew chief's done to it. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Hillary, you've been here for 4 years. Have you got to meet Shirley Muldowney?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I figured with Connie.
Oh, were you not done? Oh, okay. Do you? Okay. What? Okay. He asked what my relationship with Shirley is and what? Oh. Good question. She has paved the way for women drivers. I have a tremendous amount of respect for what she did for women drivers. I can't even imagine what it must have been like for her. I mean, she won 3 world championships. She was a great driver. I mean, and she had to have had it really tough. I mean, just the things that she did, and just being the first female and having to fight for what she wanted to do in NHRA. You know, they didn't even want to give her a license. And there was no females just that she could, you know, say, they did it, I can do it. Or it's just, she just wanted to race. She just had this desire, and she stuck with it and did it. And I don't know, I would have loved to have, like, been able to be a fly on the wall and see what it was like for her back then, you know. And just, I don't know, I just have an amazing amount of respect for what she's been able to, what she accomplished. And I'm thankful that I was able to have some time to work with her and get some advice from her. When I first came on the team, she was involved with the team, and I was able to go out to some dinners with her. We used to go shopping together. She gave me wardrobe advice. She bought, you know, we went, she really did. She gave me, she took me to her hairdresser who told me how to do my hair, and I could probably use some of it now. That's why I wear this old hat. And very interesting lady. No, pink was her color. She doesn't like anybody using her color. Pink's her color.
It was great listening to you. I had a question about, can you tell us more about the fastest race, and can you tell us, like, what's the record held by the fastest man?
The fastest man in drag racing? I think it's Tony Schumacher. Yeah, he went 337 miles an hour, so I'm just a little bit behind him. And, I don't know what else you want to know about him, but. Oh, the one that I won, or?
The one that you set the record.
Oh, that was in, actually, earlier I think I said it was in Phoenix. When we were in Phoenix testing, we went 337 miles an hour, but that was testing. So it doesn't count. So officially, we did it at Pomona that same year. It was during qualifying, and it was 334.65 miles an hour, and it was just really good conditions. Good conditions in those cars. It was probably 60 degrees outside. I remember it was starting to get dark, so the weather, you know, cool weather. Those cars like it when the humidity is low, the, 60, 70 degrees outside, not too cold, not too hot. Pomona is a really good track. It's almost like kind of downhill a little bit. There's like the secret, it's a little bit downhill, and it's a good track, sea level track, so there's no, it's not a high altitude. A lot of records are set there, and it just felt like, you know, those runs where we run fast like that are easy to drive. If that I don't know if that makes sense, because everything works right, and it just feels really smooth. Like when we ran 337 miles an hour in Phoenix, it was just awesome because it just felt like really smooth, and the car just felt like it was floating. Like if you've ever seen cars at the when they cross the finish line, they arch up, and I actually so the driver comes up, and it's just it's a great feeling because you just feel like it feels like you're floating along, and you're just going so fast. I just wish though that one time somebody else could drive and I could like look around and enjoy the scenery, because I don't get, you know, I'm focusing so hard on, you know, like I told you, I have to keep my eyes focused and look at the horizon. I don't, you know, I'm not really enjoying the, I don't get to see the scenery go by, so I don't really notice how fast I'm going. But, you know, I get the sensation, but it's just, you know, I it would just be kind of nice to be able to see the scenery going by at 335 miles an hour. But, yeah, I mean, it was just, it didn't feel like, when we went that fast, it didn't feel like, I didn't get out knowing that I had gone 335 miles an hour. Because we run those kinds of speeds, like 330, we run those fairly frequently. So.
I had a question. What's the cockpit like? Is there a pedal on the floor for an accelerator like in a car, and a clutch you step on like we do, and gears to shift through?
That's a good question.
How many gears are there and stuff?
I don't shift. I have driven cars before where I shift. This car, I was a blown alcohol car. The one that I drove right before this was a really fun car to drive because I had to rev it up on the starting line to 5,000 RPMs and hold the brake. There's a throttle pedal on my right side, clutch on my left side, and these cars, you hold the brake with your right hand, so I would rev it up to 5,000 RPMs and hold the clutch, and then meanwhile I'm staging, and then you dump the clutch at the same, when you see the amber lights come on, you dump the clutch and let go of the brake at the same time, and then you grab the steering wheel with the hand that you let go of the brake with, you grab the steering wheel, and then you shift with one hand, and then you shift into high gear with the other hand. And it's just a button on the steering wheel with this car. With the top fuel car, there's the throttle pedals on the right side, the clutches on the left side. Again, the brake was with my right hand, and I don't shift. It's just the throttle pedal goes all the way to the floor. And the only variable is if there's shake, if there's tire smoke, I have to use my right foot to either feather the throttle or pedal the throttle. But there's no, I don't do anything with the clutch or shift. I use the clutch pedal when I do the burnout. I use it to when I back up to control my speed though. I'll take my foot off the clutch to do the burnout, and then I push the clutch back in, and as I'm backing up, I just use the clutch to monitor my speed. And yeah, but the cockpit is very small, obviously. They try, you know, it's as small as, I'm just tight in there. It's fit, especially for me. I barely have room to move, you know, it's just like this much movement. There's only a forward and reverse handle on my left side, and it's designed so that when I cross the finish line, I hit the parachutes with my right hand, I push forward, hit the chutes, and then can pull right back on the brake. So it's one fluid movement, and it's that fast. So that it just happens like that. And then I also have a button on my steering wheel so that I can hit the chutes with the button also in case the car's out of shape at the top end, and I can't necessarily take my hand off the steering wheel to hit the chute, so I can just hit it with the button, and then. But eventually, I do have to take my hand off the steering wheel to pull the brakes.
you talk about the use of computer simulation for car setup? In other words, does your crew chief, for a given track, he enters a bunch of parameters and air temperature, et cetera, and then does an initial setup and tuning using simulation? Do they do that, or is it, are there other means for doing that?
Yeah, it's, well, what do you mean computer simulation?
Like a model of the car, an analytical model of the car, so that, you know, you enter in some parameterization of the conditions. Like, tracks are probably different and need to be tuned differently, I would imagine.
Yes.
And if the air temperature's 20 degrees hotter than it was a week ago, then you got to do something different. And I'm just wondering if they use, like, simulated quarter mile or 1,000 feet, you know, simulate a run of the car on a computer.
Yeah, in a sense, they do. Well, I don't. They do keep all the data from previous years, and they run their numbers from, and they're able to run, you know, if the track temperature changes this much, what's it going to do with all these given variables? You know, if we have. No, not like that. Like an actual, no, not like that, no. But they do take all these numbers into account in their tune-up. I mean, like the track temperature, all the barometric pressure, the altitude, all that. But they don't, no, they don't have a simulator, per se. No.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. How much driving do you actually have to do? When I watch on television and they're showing, you know, kind of above looking down the cars, you can see sometimes the back ends will fishtail slightly. And it looks like the drivers do have to make steering adjustments. What I'm wondering is, how much driving do you have to do? And then how do you do it because you're looking ahead? You know, what's your cue that the car is actually shifting and you need to do something to the steering wheel, I assume? And how much do you need, you know, how much do you have to do?
You never know. You know what, with these cars, you never know. When I'm sitting up there, I've got this 8,000 horsepower thing behind me, and it is the most temperamental thing. I just never know what it's going to throw at me, and I have to be ready for anything. And that's the hard part about, I'm sitting in the middle of it, and the back wheels are so far behind me. By the time I feel that the tires have moved, they've moved 3 feet. By the time I felt that they've moved a little bit. Does that make sense? Like, so by the time I felt them move, they've already moved a lot. So you have to be very quick. But at the same time, you can't be too quick. You have to really finesse it. And it's just different than a funny car. Because sometimes you don't want to move it at all. Because they run faster and quicker if you don't move. If you just stay on a string, the fastest point from A to B is little movement. So you do not want, your crew chief and your team don't want you to move that car. They just want you to keep it straight on a string. So you want to try to move it as little as possible and just keep it straight. But you can't always do that. And they're so temperamental. There's wind. There's just all these different factors. Sometimes they want to launch. They just, like I said, sometimes they're like driving a Cadillac. And you don't. Sometimes they're just easy to drive. You just don't know what they're going to do. You just have to be ready. So sometimes you don't want to steer it. Sometimes you oversteer it. You just, and there's no practice. You just have to be ready and trust yourself and react and just learn. Just learn by experience. And what I didn't mention is that we video these runs and somebody videos on my team every single run, and that is how I've learned the most, is we go back after every run, and I look at it over and over and over, and what did I do? What can I do different? And I will look at it in slow motion and think, okay, I let the car get over here. I should have steered earlier. I didn't steer enough. Or, I mean, every single run, because I don't get that many. So every time I go down the track, I mean, I analyze it to the T, you know, and, you know, sometimes I overanalyze it. But, you know, that's how I learn. And just, I mean, that's, and just go down the track and, because you just never know what they're going to throw up at you. But that's what makes it so fun. I mean, it's a great sport. It's, you never know what's it going to do. You just have to be ready. Strap myself in. Hold on.
Thanks, Hillary.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Hillary has also agreed to be at the Rolling Sculpture Car Show tomorrow. She'll be down on the Dream Street section and Liberty between 4th and 5th Ave. And if this isn't hard enough for her, she's immersed herself in with the Ann Arbor Library tomorrow and all the kids that show up. So that'll be a challenge for her, too. But I can't thank her enough for all that she's done, and I truly appreciate all of you coming tonight. And our show runs from 2 to 10 tomorrow, and hope to see all y'all there.
Thanks, you guys.